The Tiger Rising by Kate DiCamillo. Chapter 1. That morning, after he discovered the tiger, Rob went and stood under the Kentucky Star Motel sign and waited for the school bus just like it were any other day. The Kentucky Star sign was composed of a yellow neon star that rose and fell over a piece of blue neon in the shape of the state of Kentucky. Rob liked the sign. He harbored a dim but abiding notion that it would bring him good luck. Finding the tiger had been luck. He knew that. He'd been out in the woods behind the Kentucky Star Motel, way out in the woods, not really looking for anything, just wandering, hoping that maybe he would get lost or get eaten by a bear and not have to go to school ever again. That's when he saw the old Beauchamp gas station building, all boarded up and tumbled down. Next to it, there was a cage, and inside the cage, unbelievably, there was a tiger, a real-life, very large tiger pacing back and forth. He was orange and gold and so bright it was like staring at the sun itself, angry and trapped in a cage. It was early morning and it looked like it might rain. It had been raining every day for almost 2 weeks. The sky was gray and the air was thick and still. Fog was hugging the ground. To Rob, it seemed as if the tiger were some magic trick rising out of the mist. He was so astonished at his discovery, so amazed that he stood and stared, but only for a minute. He was afraid to look at the tiger for too long, afraid that the tiger would disappear. He stared, and then he turned and ran back into the woods, towards the Kentucky Star. And the whole way home, while his brain doubted what he had seen, his heart beat out the truth to him. Tiger, tiger, tiger. That was what Rob thought about as he stood beneath the Kentucky Star sign and waited for the bus. The tiger. He did not think about the rash on his legs, the itchy red blisters that snaked their way into his shoes. His father said that it would be less likely to itch if he didn't think about it. And he did not think about his mother. He hadn't thought about her since the morning of the funeral, the morning he couldn't stop crying, great sobbing heaves that made his chest and stomach hurt. His father, watching him, standing beside him, had started to cry too. They were both dressed up in suits that day. His father's suit was too small, and when he slapped Rob to make him stop crying, he ripped a hole underneath the arm of his jacket.
"There ain't no point in crying," his father had said afterwards. "Crying ain't gonna bring her back."
It had been 6 months since that day, 6 months since he and his father had moved from Jacksonville to Lister, and Rob had not cried since, not once. The final thing he did not think about that morning was getting onto the bus. He specifically did not think about Norman and Billy Threemonger waiting for him like chained and starved guard dogs, eager to attack. Rob had a way of not thinking about things. He imagined himself as a suitcase that was too full, like the one he had packed when they left Jacksonville after the funeral. He made all his feelings go inside the suitcase. He stuffed them in tight, and then sat on the suitcase and locked it shut. That was the way he not thought about things. Sometimes it was hard to keep the suitcase shut, but now he had something to put on top of it, the tiger. So, as he waited for the bus under the Kentucky Star sign, and as the first drops of rain fell from the sullen sky, Rob imagined the tiger on top of his suitcase, blinking his golden eyes, sitting proud and strong, unaffected by all the not-thoughts inside straining to come out. Chapter 2. "Looky here," said Norton Threemonger, as Rob stepped onto the school bus. "It's the Kentucky Star. How's it feel to be a star?" Norton stood in the center of the aisle, blocking Rob's path. Rob shrugged. "Oh, you don't know," Norton said to his brother. "Hey, Billy, he don't know what it's like to be a star." Rob slipped past Norton. He walked all the way to the back of the bus and sat down in the last seat. "Hey," said Billy Threemonger, "you know what? This ain't Kentucky. This is Florida." He followed Rob and sat down right next to him. He pushed his face so close that Rob could smell his breath. It was bad breath. It smelled metallic and rotten. "You ain't a Kentucky star," Billy said, his eyes glowing under the brim of his John Deere cap. "And you sure ain't a star here in Florida. You ain't a star nowhere." "Okay," said Rob. Billy shoved him hard, and then Norton came swaggering back and leaned over Billy and grabbed hold of Rob's hair with one hand and with the other hand ground his knuckles into Rob's scalp. Rob sat there and took it. If he fought back, it lasted longer. If he didn't fight back, sometimes they got bored and left him alone.
They were the only three kids on the bus until it got into town, and Mr. Nelson, the driver, pretended like he didn't know what was going on. He drove staring straight ahead, whistling songs that didn't have any melody. Rob was on his own, and he knew it.
"He's got the creeping crud all over him," said Billy. He pointed at Rob's legs. "Look," he said to Norton, "ain't it gross?"
"Uh-huh," said Norton. He was concentrating on grinding his knuckles into Rob's head. It hurt, but Rob didn't cry. He never cried. He was a pro at not crying. He was the best not-crier in the world. It drove Norton and Billy Threemonger wild. And today, Rob had the extra power of the tiger. All he had to do was think about it, and he knew there was no way he would cry. Not ever. They were still out in the country, only halfway into town, when the bus lurched to a stop. This was such a surprising development, to have the bus stop halfway through its route, that Norton stopped grinding his knuckles into Rob's scalp, and Billy stopped punching Rob in the arm.
"Hey, Mr. Nelson," Norton shouted, "what you doing?"
"This ain't a stop, Mr. Nelson," Billy called out helpfully. But Mr. Nelson ignored them. He kept whistling his non-song as he swung open the bus door. And while Norton and Billy and Rob watched, open-mouthed and silent, a girl with yellow hair and a pink lacy dress walked up the stairs and onto the bus. Chapter 3. Nobody wore pink lacy dresses to school. Nobody. Even Rob knew that. He held his breath as he watched the girl walk down the aisle of the bus. Here was somebody even stranger than he was. He was sure.
"Hey," Norton called, "this is a school bus."
"I know it," the girl said. Her voice was gravelly and deep, and the words sounded clipped and strange, like she was stamping each one of them out with a cookie cutter.
"You're all dressed up to go to a party," Billy said. "This ain't the party bus," he elbowed Rob in the ribs.
"Oh," Norton laughed. He gave Rob a friendly thud on the head. The girl stood in the center of the aisle, swaying with the movement of the bus. She stared at them.
"It's not my fault you don't have good clothes," she said finally. She sat down and put her back to them.
"Hey," said Norton, "we're sorry. We didn't mean nothing." "Hey," he said again, "what's your name?"
The girl turned and looked at them. She had a sharp nose and a sharp chin and black, black eyes.
"Sistine," she said. "Sistine," hooted Billy. "What kind of stupid name is that?"
"Like the chapel," she said slowly, making each word clear and strong. Rob stared at her, amazed.
"What are you looking at?" she asked him.
Rob shook his head.
"Yeah," said Norton. He cuffed Rob in the ear. "What are you staring at, disease boy? Come on," he said to Billy.
And together they swaggered up the aisle of the bus and sat in the seat behind the new girl. They whispered things to her, but Rob couldn't hear what they were saying. He thought about the Sistine Chapel. He had seen a picture of it in that big art book that Mrs. Dupree kept on a small shelf behind her desk in the library. The pages of the book were slick and shiny, and each picture made Rob feel cool and sweet inside, like a drink of water on a hot day. Mrs. Dupree let Rob look at the book because he was quiet and good in the library, and it was her reward to him. In the book, the picture from the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel showed God reaching out and touching Adam. It was like they were playing a game of tag, like God was making Adam it. It was a beautiful picture. Rob looked out the window at the gray rain and the gray sky and the gray highway. He thought about the tiger. He thought about God and Adam. And he thought about Sistine. He did not think about the rash. He did not think about his mother. And he did not think about Norton and Billy Threemonger. He kept the suitcase closed. Chapter 4. Sistine was in Rob's sixth-grade homeroom class. Mrs. Soames had made her stand up and introduce herself.
"My name," she said in her gravelly voice, "is Sistine Bailey."
She stood at the front of the room in her pink dress, and all the kids stared at her with their open mouths as she had just stepped off a spaceship from another planet. Rob looked down at his desk. He knew not to stare at her. He started working on a drawing of the tiger.
"What a lovely name," said Mrs. Soames.
"Thank you," said Sistine. Patrice Wilkins, who sat in front of Rob, snorted and then giggled and covered her mouth.
"I'm from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania," Sistine said, "home of the Liberty Bell, and I hate the South because the people in it are ignorant, and I'm not staying here in Lister. My father's coming to get me next week."
She looked around the room defiantly.
"Well," said Mrs. Soames, Thank you very much for introducing yourself, Sistine Bailey. You may take your seat before you put your foot in your mouth any further.
The whole class laughed at that. Rob looked up just as Sistine sat down. She glared at him. Then she stuck her tongue out at him.
Him! He shook his head and went back to his drawing.
He sketched out the tiger, but what he wanted to do was whittle it in wood. His mother had shown him how to whittle and how to take a piece of wood and make it come alive. She taught him when she was sick. He sat on the edge of the bed and watched her tiny white hands closely.
"Don't jiggle that bed," his father said. "Your aunt Mama's in a lot of pain."
"He ain't hurting me, Robert," his mother said.
"Don't get all tired out with that wood," his father said.
"It's all right," his mother said. "I'm just teaching Rob some things I know." But she didn't have to teach him much. His mother told him he already knew what to do. His hands knew, that's what she said.
"Rob," said the teacher, "I need you to go to the principal's office."
Rob didn't hear her. He was working on the tiger, trying to remember what his eyes looked like.
"Robert," Mrs. Soames said. "Robert Horton?"
Rob looked up. Robert was his father's name. Robert was what his mother had called his father.
"Mr. Felmer wants to see you in his office. Do you understand?"
"Yes, ma'am," said Rob. He got up and took his picture of the tiger and folded it up and put it in the back pocket of his shorts. On his way out of the classroom, Jason Utmeyer tripped him and said, "See you later, retard."
And Sistine looked up at him with her tiny black eyes. She shot him a look of pure hate.
Chapter 5. The principal's office was small and dark and smelled like pipe tobacco. The secretary looked up at Rob when he walked in.
"Go right on back," she said, nodding her big blonde head of hair. "He's waiting for you."
"Rob," said Mr. Felmer when Rob stepped into his office.
"Yes, sir," said Rob.
"Have a seat,"
Mr. Felmer said, waving his hand at the orange plastic chair in front of his desk. Rob sat down. Mr. Felmer cleared his throat. He patted the piece of hair that was combed over his bald head. He cleared his throat again.
"Rob, we're a bit worried," he finally said.
Rob nodded. This was how Mr. Felmer began all of his talks with Rob. He was always worried that Rob did not interact with the other students, worried that he did not communicate, worried that he wasn't doing well in any way at school.
"It's about your legs, Yes, your legs. Have you been putting that medicine on them?"
"Yes, sir," said Rob. He didn't look at Mr. Felmer. He stared instead at the paneled wall behind the principal's head. It was covered with an astonishing array of framed pieces of papers, certificates and diplomas and thank you notes.
"May I look?"
asked Mr. Felmer. He got up from his chair and came halfway around the desk and stared at Rob's legs.
"Well, sir," he said after a minute.
He went back behind his desk and sat down. He folded his hands together and cracked his knuckles. He cleared his throat.
"Here's the situation, Rob. Some of the parents, I won't mention any names, are worried that what you've got there might be contagious. Contagious meaning something that the other students could possibly catch." Mr. Felmer cleared his throat again. He stared at Rob.
"Tell me the truth, son. Have you been using that medicine you told me about? The stuff the doctor in Jacksonville gave you? Have you been putting that on?"
"Yes, sir," said Rob.
"Well," said Mr. Felmer, "let me tell you what I think. Let me be upfront and honest with you. I think it might be a good idea if we had you stay home for a few days. What we'll do is just give that old medicine more of a chance to kick in. Let it start working its magic on you, and then we'll have you come back to school when your legs have cleared up. What do you think about that plan?"
Rob stared down at his legs. He felt the picture of the tiger burning in his pocket. He concentrated on keeping his heart from singing out loud with joy.
"Yes, sir," he said slowly. "That would be all right."
"That's right," said Mr. Felmer. "I thought you would think it's a good plan. I tell you what I'll do. I'll just write your parents, I mean your father, a note, and tell him what's what. He can give me a call if he wants. We can talk about it."
"Yes, sir," said Rob again. He kept his head down. He was afraid to look up.
Mr. Felmer cleared his throat and scratched his head and adjusted his piece of hair and started to write. When he was done, he handed the note to Rob. Rob took it, and when he was outside the principal's office, he folded the piece of paper up carefully and put it in his back pocket with the drawing of the tiger. And then, finally, he smiled. He smiled because he knew something Mr. Felmer did not know. He knew that his legs would never clear up. He was free. Chapter 6.
Rob floated through the rest of the morning. He went to math class and civics and science, his heart light, buoyed by the knowledge that he would never have to come back. At lunch, he sat out on the benches in the breezeway. He did not go into the lunchroom. Norton and Billy Threemonger were there. And nothing had tasted good to him since his mother died, especially not the food at school. It was worse than the food his father tried to cook. He sat on the bench and unfolded his drawing of the tiger, and his fingers itched to start making it in wood. He was sitting like that, swinging his legs, studying the drawing, when he heard shouting and the high-pitched buzz of excitement, like crickets that the kids made when something was happening. He stayed where he was. In a minute, the faded red double doors of the lunchroom swung open and Sistine Bailey came marching up through them, her head held high. Behind her was a whole group of kids, and just when Sistine noticed Rob sitting there on the bench, one of the kids threw something at her. Rob couldn't tell what, but it hit her, whatever it was. "Run," he wanted to yell at her. "Hurry up and run." But he didn't say anything. He knew better than to say anything. He just sat and stared at Sistine with his mouth open, and she stared back at him. Then she turned and walked back into the group of kids like somebody walking into deep water. And suddenly, she began swinging with her fists. She was kicking. She was twirling. Then the group of kids closed in around her, and she seemed to disappear. Rob stood up so that he could see her better. He caught sight of her pink dress. It looked all crumpled like a wadded-up tissue. He saw her arms still going like mad. "Hey," he shouted, not meaning to. "Hey," he shouted again, louder. He moved closer, the drawing of the tiger still in his hand. "Leave her alone," he shouted, not believing the words were coming from him. They heard him then and turned to him. It was quiet for a minute.
"Who are you talking to?" a big girl with black hair asked.
"Yeah," another girl said. "Who do you think you're talking to?"
"Go away," Sistine muttered in her gravelly voice. But she didn't look at him. Her yellow hair was stuck to her forehead with sweat. The girl with the black hair pushed up close to him. She shoved him. "Leave her alone," Rob said again.
"You going to make me?" the black-haired girl said.
They were all looking at him, waiting. Sistine was waiting, too, waiting for him to do something. He looked down at the ground and saw what they had thrown at her. It was an apple. He stared at it for what seemed like a long time, and when he looked back up, they were all still waiting to see what he would do. And so he ran. And after a minute, he could tell that they were running after him. He didn't need to look back to see if they were there. He knew it. He knew the feeling of being chased. He dropped the picture of the tiger and ran full out, pumping his legs and arms hard. They were still behind him. A sudden thrill went through him when he realized that what he was doing was saving Sistine Bailey. Why he would try to save Sistine Bailey, why he would want to save somebody who hated him, he couldn't say. He just ran, and the bell rang before they caught him. He was late for his English class because he had to walk from the gym all the way to the front of the school. And he did not know where his drawing of the tiger was, but he still had Mr. Filmer's note in his back pocket, and that was all that truly mattered to him, the note that proved that he would never have to come back. Chapter 7. It turned out to be an extraordinary day in almost every possible way. It started with finding the tiger, and it ended with Sistine Bailey sitting down right next to him on the bus on the way home from school. Her dress was torn and muddied. There was a scrape down her right arm, and her hair stuck out in 100 different directions. She sat down in the empty seat beside him and stared at him with her black eyes. "There isn't any place else to sit," she said to him. "This is the last empty seat." Rob shrugged. "It's not like I want to sit here," she said. "Okay," said Rob. He shrugged his shoulders again. He hoped that she wasn't going to thank him for saving her. "What's your name?" she demanded. "Rob Horton," he told her. "Well, let me tell you something, Rob Horton. You shouldn't run. That's what they want you to do. Run." Rob stared at her with his mouth open. She stared back. "I hate it here," she said, looking away from him, her voice even deeper than before. "This is a stupid hick town with stupid hick teachers. Nobody in the whole school even knows what the Sistine Chapel is." "I know," said Rob. "I know what the Sistine Chapel is." Immediately he regretted saying it. It was his policy not to say things, but it was a policy he was having a hard time maintaining around Sistine. "I bet," Sistine sneered at him. "I bet you know." "It's a picture of God making the world," he said. Sistine stared at him hard.
She narrowed her small eyes until they almost disappeared.
"It's in Italy," said Rob. "The pictures are painted on the ceiling. They're frescoes."
It was as if a magician had cast a spell over him. He opened his mouth and the words fell out one on top of another, like gold coins. He couldn't stop talking.
"I don't got to go to school on account of my legs. I got a note that says so. Mr. Felmer, he's the principal, says the parents are worried that what I got is contagious. That means that the other kids could catch it."
"I know what contagious means," Sistine said. She looked at his legs, and then she did something truly astounding. She closed her eyes and reached out her left hand and placed it on top of Rob's right leg.
"Please let me catch it," she whispered.
"You won't," Rob said, surprised at her hand, how small it was and how warm. It made him think for a minute of his mother's hand, tiny and soft. He stopped that thought. "It ain't contagious," he told her.
"Please let me catch it," Sistine whispered again, ignoring him, keeping her hand on his leg. "Please let me catch it so I won't have to go to school."
"It ain't a disease," said Rob. "It's just me."
"Shut up," Sistine said.
She sat up very straight. Her lips moved. The other kids shouted and screamed and laughed and called to each other. But the two of them just sat apart from it all as if there was an island in a sea of sweat and exhaust. Sistine opened her eyes. She took her hand away and rubbed it up and down on both her legs.
"You're crazy," Rob told her.
"Where do you live?" Sistine asked, still rubbing her hands over her legs.
"In the motel, in the Kentucky Star."
"You live in a motel?" she asked him.
"It ain't permanent," he told her. "It's just until we get back on our feet."
Sistine stared at him.
"I'll bring you your homework," she said. "I'll bring it to you at the motel."
"Well, I don't want my homework," he told her.
"So?" said Sistine.
By then, Norton and Billy Threemonger had spotted them sitting together, and they were moving in. Rob was relieved when the first thump came to the back of his head, because it meant that he wouldn't have to talk to Sistine anymore. It meant that he wouldn't end up saying too much, telling her about important things, like his mother or the tiger. He was glad, almost, that Norton and Billy were there to beat him into silence.
Chapter 8.
His father read the note from the principal slowly, putting his big finger under the words as if they were bugs he was trying to keep still. When he was finally done, he laid the letter on the table and rubbed his eyes with his fingers and sighed. The rain beat a sad rhythm on the roof of the motel.
"That stuff ain't nothing anybody could catch," his father said.
"I know it," Rob said. "I already told that to the principal once before. I called up there and told him that."
"Yes, sir," said Rob.
His father sighed. He stopped rubbing his eyes and looked at Rob.
"You want to stay home?" he asked.
Rob nodded. His father sighed again.
"Maybe I'll make an appointment and get one of them doctors to write down what you got ain't catching, all right?"
"Yes, sir," said Rob.
"But I won't do it for a few days. I'll give you some time off."
"That would be all right," said Rob.
"You got to fight them, you know, them boys. I know you don't want to, but you got to fight them, else they won't ever leave you alone."
Rob nodded. He saw Sistine twirling and punching and kicking, and the vision made him smile.
"In the meantime, you can help me out around here," his father said. "Do some of the maintenance man work at the motel. Do some sweeping and cleaning for me. Beauchamp's running me ragged. They ain't enough hours in the day to do everything that man wants done. Now go on and hand me that medicine."
His father slathered and slapped the fishy-smelling ointment on Rob's legs, and Rob concentrated on holding still.
"Do you think Beauchamp is the richest man in the world?" he asked his father.
"No," his father said. "He don't own but this one itty-bitty motel now, and in the woods. He just likes to pretend he's rich, is all."
"Why?"
"I was just wondering," said Rob.
He was thinking about the tiger pacing back and forth in the cage. He was certain that the tiger belonged to Beauchamp. And wouldn't you have to be the richest man in the world to own a tiger?
Rob wanted desperately to go see the tiger again, but he was afraid that he had imagined the whole thing. He was afraid that the tiger might have disappeared with the morning mist.
"Can I go outside?" Rob asked his father when he was done.
"No," his father said. "I don't want that medicine rained off you. It costs too much."
Rob was relieved, almost, that he had to stay inside. What if he went looking for the tiger and he was not there? Rob's father cooked the macaroni and cheese for supper on the two-burner hot plate that he kept on the table next to the TV. He boiled the macaroni too long, and a lot of it stuck to the pan,
so there weren't many noodles to go around with the powdery cheese.
"Someday," he told Rob, "you and me will have a house with a real stove, and I'll do some good cooking then."
"This is good," Rob lied.
"You eat all you want. I ain't that hungry," his father told him.
After supper, his father fell asleep in the recliner with his head thrown back and mouth open. He snored, and his feet, big with crooked toes, jerked and trembled. In between the snores, his stomach growled long and loud, as if he were the hungriest man in the world. Rob sat on his bed and started to work on carving the tiger. He had a good piece of maple, and his knife was sharp, and in his mind he could see the tiger clearly. But something different came out of the wood. It wasn't a tiger at all. It was a person, with a sharp nose and small eyes and skinny legs. It wasn't until he started working on the dress that Rob realized he was carving Sistine. He stopped for a minute and held the wood out in front of him and shook his head in wonder. It was just like his mother had always said. You could never tell what would come out of the wood. It did what it wanted, and you just followed. He stayed up late working on the carving, and when he finally did fall asleep, he dreamt about the tiger, only it wasn't in a cage. It was free and running through the woods, and there was something on its back, but Rob couldn't tell what it was. As the tiger got closer and closer, Rob saw that the thing was Sistine in her pink party dress. She was riding the tiger. In his dream, Rob waved her, and she waved back at him, but she didn't stop. She and the tiger kept going past Rob, deeper and deeper into the woods. Chapter 9. His father woke him up at 5:30 the next morning. "Come on, son," he said, shaking Rob's shoulder. "Come on, you're a working man now. You got to get up." He took his hand away and stood over Rob for a minute more and then left. Rob heard the door to the motel room squeak open. He opened his eyes. The world was dark. The only light came from the falling Kentucky star. Rob turned over in bed and pulled back the curtain and looked out the window at the sign. It was like having his own personal shooting star, but he didn't ever make a wish on it. He was afraid that if he started wishing, he might not be able to stop. In his suitcase of not thoughts, there were also not wishes. He kept the lid closed on them, too. Rob leaned on his elbow and stared at the star and listened to the rain gently drumming its fingers on the roof. There was a warm, glowing kind of feeling in his stomach, a feeling that he wasn't used to. It took him a minute to name it. The tiger. The tiger was out there. He got out of bed and put on shorts and a t-shirt. "Still hot," his father said when Rob stepped out the door, "and still raining." "Uh-huh," said Rob, rubbing his eyes. "Yes, sir. And if it don't stop soon, the whole state ain't going to be nothing but one big swamp." "The rain doesn't bother me," Rob muttered. On the day of his mother's funeral, it had been so sunshiny that it hurt his eyes. And after the funeral, he and his father had to stand outside in the hot, bright sun and shake everybody's hand. Some of the ladies hugged Rob, pulled him in close to them in jerky, desperate movements, smashing his head into their pillowy chests. "If you don't look just like her," they told him, rocking him back and forth and holding on to him just right. Or they said, "You got your mama's hair, that cobwebby blonde," and they ran their fingers through his hair and patted his head like he was a dog. And every time Rob's father extended his hand to someone else, Rob saw the ripped place in his suit, where it had split open when he slapped Rob to make him stop crying. And it reminded Rob again, "Do not cry, do not cry." That was what the sun made him think of. The funeral. And so he didn't care if he ever saw the sun again. He didn't care if the whole state did turn into a swamp. His father stood and went back into the motel room and got himself a cup of coffee and brought it back outside. The steam rose off of it and he curled into the air. "Now that I'm a working man," Rob said shyly, "could I drink some coffee?" His father smiled at him. "Well," he said, "I guess that'd be all right." Rob went inside and poured himself a mug of coffee and brought it back outside and sat down next to his father and sipped it slowly. It tasted hot and dark and bitter. He liked it. "All right," his father said after about 10 minutes. "It's time to get to work." He stood up. It wasn't even 6 o'clock. As they walked together alongside the back of the motel to the maintenance shed, his father started to whistle "Mining for Gold." It was a sad song he used to sing with Rob's mother.
Her high, sweet voice had gone swooping over her mother's deep one like a small bird flying over the solid world. His father must have remembered, too, because he stopped halfway through the song and shook his head and cursed softly under his breath. Rob let his father walk ahead of him. He slowed down and stared into the woods, wanted to see some small part of the tiger, a flick of his tail or a glow from his eyes. But there was nothing to see except for rain and darkness. "Come on, son," his father said, his voice hard, and Rob hurried to catch up. Chapter 10. Rob was sweeping the laundry room when Willie May, the Kentucky Star's housekeeper, came in and threw herself down in one of the metal chairs that were lined up against the cement block wall. "You know what?" she said to Rob. "No, ma'am," said Rob. "I'll tell you what," said Willie May. She reached up and adjusted the butterfly clip in her thick black hair. "I'd rather be sweeping up after some pigs in a barn than cleaning up after people in this place. Pigs at least give you some respect." Rob leaned on his broom and stared at Willie May. He liked looking at her. Her face was smooth and dark, like a beautiful piece of wood. And Rob liked to think that if he'd been the one who'd carved Willie May, he would have made her just the way she was, with her long nose and high cheekbones and slanted eyes. "What are you staring at?" Willie May asked, her eyes narrowed. "What are you doing out of school?" Rob shrugged. "I don't know," he said. "What do you mean you don't know?" Rob shrugged again. "Don't be moving your shoulders up and down in front of me, acting like some skinny old bird trying to fly away. You want to end up cleaning motel rooms for a living?" Rob shook his head. "Well, that's right. Ain't nobody wants this job. I'm the only fool Beauchamp can pay to do it." "You got to stay in school," she said, "else you'll end up like me." She shook her head and reached into the pocket of her dress and pulled out a single cigarette and two sticks of eight-ball licorice gum. She put one piece of gum in her mouth and handed the other to Rob, lit up her cigarette, leaned back in the chair, and closed her eyes. "Now," she said, the scent of smoke and licorice filling the laundry room, "go on and tell me why you ain't in school." "On account of my legs being all broke out," said Rob. Willie May opened her eyes and looked over the top of her glasses at Rob's legs. "Hmm," she said after a minute. "How long you had that?" "About 6 months," said Rob. "I can tell you how to cure that," said Willie May, pointing with her cigarette at his legs. "I can tell you right now. You don't need to go no doctor." "Huh?" said Rob. He stopped chewing his gum and held his breath. What if Willie May healed him and then he had to go back to school? "Sadness," said Willie May, closing her eyes and nodding at him. "You keep all that sadness down low in your legs. You're not letting it get up to your heart where it belongs. You gotta let that sadness rise on up." "Oh," said Rob. He let his breath out. He was relieved Willie May was wrong. She couldn't cure him. "The principal thinks it's contagious," he said. "Man ain't got no sense," Willie May said. "He's got lots of certificates," Rob offered. "They're all framed and hung on those wall." "I bet he ain't got no certificate for sense, though," said Willie May darkly. She rose up out of her chair and stretched. "I gotta clean some more rooms," she said. "You ain't gonna forget what I told you about them legs, are you?" "No, ma'am." "What'd I tell you then?" she said, towering over him. Willie May was tall, the tallest person Rob had ever seen. "To let the sadness rise," Rob said. He repeated the words as if they were part of a poem. He gave them a certain rhyme, the same way Willie May had when she'd said them. "That's right," said Willie May. "You gotta let the sadness rise on up." She left the room in a swirl of licorice and smoke. After she was gone, Rob wished that he had told her about the tiger. He felt a sudden desperate need to tell somebody, somebody who wouldn't doubt him, somebody who was capable of believing in tigers. Chapter 11. That afternoon, Rob was out in front of the Kentucky Star, weeding between the cracks in the sidewalk, when the school bus rumbled up. "Hey," he heard Norton Threemonger yell. Rob didn't look up. He concentrated on the weeds. "Hey, disease boy," Norton shouted. "We know what you got. It's called leprosy." "Yeah," Billy shouted. "Leprosy. All of your body parts are going to fall off." "They're going to rot off," Norton yelled. "Yeah," Billy screamed. "That's what I meant. Rot. They're going to rot off." Rob stared at the sidewalk and imagined the tiger eating Norton and Billy, Threemonger, and then spitting out their bones. "Hey," Norton shouted. "Here comes your girlfriend, disease boy." The bus coughed and sputtered and finally roared away. Rob looked up. Sistine was walking toward him. She was wearing a lime green dress. As she got closer, he could see that it was torn and dirty. "I brought your homework," she said.
She held out a red notebook stuffed full of papers. The knuckles on her hands were bleeding.
"Thank you," said Rob.
He took the notebook. He was determined to say nothing else to her. He was determined to keep his words inside of him, where they belonged. Sistine shared past him at the motel. It was an ugly two-story building, squat and small, composed entirely of cement block. The doors of each room were painted a different color, pink or blue or green, and there was a chair painted in a matching color sitting in front of each door.
"Why is this place called the Kentucky Star?" Sistine asked.
"Because," Rob said. It was the shortest answer he could think of.
"Because why?" she asked.
Rob sighed. "Because Beauchamp, the man who owns it, he had a horse once called Kentucky Star."
"Well," said Sistine, "it's a stupid name for a hotel in Florida."
Rob shrugged. It started to rain. Sistine stood in front of him and continued to stare. She looked at the motel and then over at the blinking Kentucky Star sign, and then she looked back at him, and as if it were all a math equation she were trying to make come out right in her head. The rain made her hair stick to her scalp. It made her dress droopy. Rob looked at her small, pinched face and her bleeding knuckles and dark eyes, and he felt something inside of him open up. It was the same way he felt when he picked up a piece of wood and started working on it, not knowing what it would be, and then watching it turn into something he recognized. He took a breath. He opened his mouth and let the words fall out.
"I know where there's a tiger."
Sistine stood in the drizzly rain and stared at him, her eyes black and fierce. She didn't say, "a real one." She didn't say, "are you crazy?" She didn't say, "you're a big old liar." She said one word, "where?" And Rob knew then that he had picked the right person to tell.
Chapter 12.
"We got to walk through the woods," Rob said. He looked doubtfully at Sistine's bright dress and shiny black shoes.
"You can give me some of your clothes to wear," she told him. "I hate this dress anyway."
And so he took her to the motel room, and there Sistine stood and stared at the unmade beds and the tattered recliner. Her eyes moved over his father's gun case and then went to the macaroni pan from the night before, still sitting on the edge of the hot plate. She looked at it all the same way she'd looked at the Kentucky Star sign in the motel, and him, like she was trying to add it all up in her head. Then she saw his carvings, the little wooden village of odd things that he had made, and he had them all on a TV dinner tray beside his bed.
"Oh," she said. Her voice sounded different, lighter.
"Where did you get those?"
She went and bent over the tray and studied the carvings, the blue jay and the pine tree and the Kentucky Star sign and the one that he was particularly proud of his father's right foot, life-size and accurate, right down to the little toe. She picked them up one by one and placed them back down carefully.
"Where did you get them?" she asked again.
"I made them," said Rob.
She did not doubt him as some people would. Instead, she said, "Michelangelo, the man who painted the Sistine Chapel, he sculpted too."
"You're a sculptor," she said. "You're an artist."
"No," said Rob. He shook his head. He felt a hot wave of embarrassment and joy roll over him. It lit his rash on fire. He bent and rubbed his hands down his leg, trying to calm them. When he straightened back up, he saw that Sistine had picked up the carving of her. He had left it lying on his bed, intending to work on it again that evening. He held his breath as she stared at the piece of wood. It looked so much like her, with her skinny legs and small eyes and defiant stance, that he was certain she would be angry. But once again she surprised him.
"Oh," she said, her voice full of wonder, "it's perfect. It's like looking at a little wooden mirror."
She stared at it a minute more and then carefully laid it back on his bed.
"Give me some clothes," she said, "and we'll go see the tiger."
He gave her a pair of pants and a T-shirt and left the room and went outside to wait for her. It was still raining, but not hard. He looked at the falling Kentucky Star. He thought for a minute about one of those not wishes he had buried deepest, a friend. He stared at the star and felt the hope and need and fear course through him in a hot neon arc. He shook his head.
"No," he said to Kentucky Star, "no."
And then he sighed and stuck his legs out into the rain, hoping to cool them off, hoping to get some small amount of relief.
Chapter 13. They walked together through the scrub. The rain had stopped, but the whole world was wet. The pines and the palmettos and the sad clusters of dead orange trees all dripped wet.
"This is where my mother grew up," Sistine said, swinging her arms wide as she walked. "Right here in Lister. And she said that she always told herself that if she ever made it out of here, she was never coming back.
but now she's back because my father had an affair with his secretary, whose name is Bridget, and who can't type, which is really bad thing for a secretary not to be able to do. And my mother left when she found out. He's coming down here to get me. Soon. Next week. I'm going to go live with him. I'm not staying here, that's for sure. Rob felt a familiar loneliness rise up and drape his arm over his shoulder. She wasn't staying. There was no point in wishing. The suitcase needed to stay closed. He stared at Sistine's shiny shoes and willed his sadness to go away. "Ain't you worried about messing up your shoes?" he asked her. "No," she said. "I hate these shoes. I hate every piece of clothing that mother makes me wear. Does your mother live with you?" Rob shook his head. "Nah," he said. "Where is she?" Rob shrugged his shoulders. "My mother's going to open up a store downtown. It's going to be an art store. She's going to bring some culture to the area. She could sell some of your wooden sculptures." "They ain't sculptures," Rob protested. "They're just whittling, that's all. And we got to be quiet because Beauchamp doesn't want people walking around on his land." "Is this his land?" Sistine asked. "Everything is," said Rob. "The motel and these woods." "He can't own everything," Sistine argued. "Besides," she said, "I don't care. He can catch us. He could put us in jail for trespassing. I don't care." "If we're in jail, we won't get to see the tiger," said Rob. "Where's your mother?" Sistine said suddenly. She stopped walking and stared at him. "Shh," said Rob. "You got to be quiet." He kept walking. "I do not have to be quiet," Sistine called after him. "I want to know where your mother is." He turned around and looked at her. His hands were on his hips. Her black eyes were narrowed. "I don't want to see your stupid tiger," she shouted. "I don't care about it. You don't know how to talk to people. I told you about my father and my mother and Bridget. You didn't say anything. You won't even tell me about your mother." Keeping her hands on her hips, she turned around and started marching back in the direction of the Kentucky Star. "Keep your stupid secret," she shouted. "Keep your stupid tiger, too. I don't care." Rob watched her. Because she was wearing his jeans and shirt, it looked like looking into a funhouse mirror. It was like watching himself walk away. He shrugged and bent to scratch his legs. He told himself that he didn't care. He told himself that she was leaving soon anyways. But when he looked up and saw her getting smaller and smaller, it reminded him of his dream. He remembered Sistine riding into the woods in the back of the tiger, and suddenly he couldn't bear the thought of watching her disappear again. "Wait," he shouted. "Wait up," and he started running toward her. Sistine stopped and turned. She waited for him with her hands on her hip. "Well," she said when he got close to her. "She's dead," he told her. The words came out in short, ragged gasps. "My mama's dead." "Okay," said Sistine. She gave a quick, professional nod of her head. She stepped towards him, and Rob turned, and together they walked back in the other direction, toward the tiger. Chapter 14. The cage was made out of rusted chain-link fence, and there was a wood board that served as a roof. And there was a chain-link door that was locked tight with three padlocks. Inside the cage, the tiger was still pacing back and forth just as he had been the last time Rob saw him, as if he had never stopped pacing, or as if Rob had never gone away. "Oh," said Sistine in the same voice she had used when she saw Rob's carvings, "he's beautiful." "Don't get too close," Rob ordered. "He might not like it if you stand too close." But the tiger ignored them. He concentrated on pacing. He was so enormous and bright that it was hard to look directly at him. "It's just like the poem says," Sistine breathed. "What?" said Rob. "The poem, the one that goes, 'Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forest of the night.' That poem, it's just like that. He burns bright." "Oh," said Rob. He nodded. He liked the fierce and beautiful way the words sounded. Just as he was getting ready to ask Sistine to say them again, she whirled around and faced him. "What's he doing way out here?" she demanded. Rob shrugged. "I don't know," he said. "He's Beauchamp's, I guess." "Beauchamp's what?" said Sistine. "His pet?" "I don't know," said Rob. "I just like looking at him. Maybe Beauchamp does too. Maybe he just likes to come out here and look at him." "Well, that's selfish," said Sistine. Rob shrugged. "Well, this ain't right for this tiger to be in a cage. It's not right." "We can't do nothing about it," Rob said. "We could let him go," said Sistine. "We could set him free." She put her hands on her hips. It was a gesture that Rob had already come to recognize and be wary of. "We can't," he said. "There's all them locks. We can saw through them." "No," said Rob. The mere thought of letting the tiger go made his legs itch like crazy. "We have to set him free," Sistine said, her voice loud and certain. "Nuh-uh," said Rob.
It ain't our tiger to let go.
It's our tiger to save, Sistine said fiercely. The tiger stopped pacing. He prickled his ears back and forth, looking somewhere past Sistine and Rob.
Shh, said Rob. The tiger cocked his head. All three of them listened.
It's a car, said Rob. A car's coming. It's Beauchamp. We gotta go. Come on.
He grabbed her hand and pulled her into the woods. She ran with him. She let him hold on to her hand. It was an impossibly small and bony hand, as delicate as the skeleton of a baby bird. They ran together, and Rob felt his heart move inside him, not from fear or exertion, but from something else. It was as if his soul had grown and was pushing everything up higher in his body. It was an oddly familiar feeling, but he couldn't remember what it was called.
"Is he behind us?" Sistine asked breathlessly.
Rob shrugged. It was hard to move his shoulders up and down and keep hold of Sistine's hand at the same time. Sistine said, "Stop shrugging your shoulders at me. I hate it. I hate the way you shrug all the time."
That made Rob remember Willie May saying that when he shrugged, he looked like a skinny bird trying to fly. It struck him as funny now. He laughed out loud at the thought of it. And without asking him what he was laughing about, without dropping his hand, without stopping, Sistine laughed too. Then Rob remembered the name of the feeling that was pushing up inside him and filling him to the overflowing. It was happiness. That's what it was called.
Chapter 15. By the time they made it back to the motel parking lot, it was dark outside, and they were both laughing so hard they could barely walk. "Rob," said his father. He was standing at the door to their room. The blue-gray light from inside seeped out around him.
"Yes, sir," said Rob. He dropped Sistine's hand. He stood up straight.
"Where you been?"
"Out in the woods."
"Did you finish up all them jobs I told you to do?"
"Yes, sir," said Rob.
"Who you got with you?" his father said, squinting in the darkness. Sistine drew herself up tall.
"This is Sistine," said Rob.
"Uh-huh," his father said, still squinting. "You live around here?" he asked.
"For now."
"Your parents know you're out here?"
"I was going to call my mother," said Sistine.
"There's a payphone down in the laundry room," said Rob's father.
"In the laundry room," Sistine repeated, her voice full of disbelief. She put her hands on her hips.
"We don't got a phone in the room," Rob said to her softly.
"Good grief," said Sistine. "Well, can I have some change at least?"
Rob's father reached into his pants pocket and pulled out a handful of coins. He balanced the money in the palm of his hand as if he was preparing to do a magic trick, and Rob stepped forward and took the coins from him and handed them to Sistine.
"Do you want me to go with you?" he asked her.
"No," she said. "I'll find it. Thank you very much."
"Rob's," his father said as Sistine marched away, swinging her arms. "What's that girl doing in your clothes?"
"She had on a dress," Rob said. "It was too pretty to wear out into the woods."
"Come on in here," his father commanded. "Let's get that medicine on your legs."
"Yes, sir," said Rob. He walked toward the room slowly. His happiness had evaporated. His legs itched, and the motel room he knew would be as dark as a cave, lit only by the gray light of the TV. When his mother was alive, the world had seemed full of light. The Christmas before she died, she had strung the outside of their house in Jacksonville with hundreds of white lights. Every night, the house lit up like a constellation, and they were all inside it together, the three of them, and they were happy. Rob remembered, and as he remembered, he stepped into the motel room. He shook his head and scolded himself for opening the suitcase. Just thinking about all those things that were gone now seemed to make the darkness darker.
Chapter 16. Rob sat out on the curb in front of the motel room and waited for Sistine to come back from using the phone. He had her green dress wrapped up in a grocery bag. He had tried to fold the dress up neatly, but folding a dress turned out to be an impossible task, and he finally gave up. Now he held the bag out and away from him so that the grease from the medicine in his legs would not stain it. He was relieved when Sistine finally walked up to him out of the darkness.
"Hey," he said.
"Hi," she sat down on the steps next to him.
"How come you don't have a phone?"
Rob shrugged. "Ain't got nobody to call, I guess."
"My mother's coming to get me," Sistine said.
Rob nodded. "Here's your dress," he handed her the bag. Sistine took it and then tilted her head to look up at the sky. Rob looked up too. The clouds had shifted, and there were clear patches where the stars shone through.
"I can see the Big Dipper," Sistine said. "I like looking up at things. So do my mom and dad. That's how they met. They were both looking up at the ceiling in the Sistine Chapel, and they weren't watching where they were going, and they bumped into each other.
That's why I'm named Sistine.
I like your name, said Rob shyly.
I've seen the Sistine ceiling too, she said. They took me last year, before Bridget, when they were still in love.
Does it look like the pictures, Rob asked?
Better, said Sistine. It's like, I don't know, it's like looking at fireworks, kind of.
Oh, said Rob. Maybe we could go to Italy sometime, and I could show you.
That would be all right, said Rob. He smiled into the darkness.
That tiger can't look up at the stars, said Sistine, her voice getting hard. He's got that piece of wood all over his head.
He can't look up at all. We've got to let him go.
Rob was silent. He was hoping that if he didn't answer her, she might go back to talking about the Sistine ceiling.
How did your mother die? She asked suddenly.
Rob sighed. He knew there was no point in trying not to answer.
Cancer, he said.
What was her name?
I ain't supposed to talk about her, said Rob, closing his eyes to the stars and concentrating instead on his suitcase, working to keep it closed.
Why not? Asked Sistine.
Because my dad said it don't do no good to talk about it. Says she's gone and she ain't coming back. That's why we moved here from Jacksonville, because everybody always wanted to talk about her. We moved down here to get on with things.
There was a crunch of gravel. Rob opened up his eyes and to see the headlights of cars sweep over them.
That's my mother, said Sistine. She stood up.
Quick, she said. Tell me your mother's name.
Rob shook his head.
Say it, she demanded.
Caroline, Robert said softly, cracking his suitcase open and letting the words slip out.
Sistine gave him another businesslike nod of her head.
Okay, she said. I'll come back tomorrow. We'll make our plans for letting the tiger go.
Sissy, called a voice. Baby, what in the world? What in the world are you doing out here?
Sistine's mother got out of the car and came walking toward them. She had on high heels, and she wobbled as she walked in the gravel parking lot of the Kentucky Star. Her hair was a lighter shade of yellow than Sistine's and piled up high. When she turned her head, Rob recognized Sistine's profile, her sharp chin and pointed nose, but the mouth was different, tighter.
Good Lord, said Mrs. Bailey to Sistine. What have you got on?
Clothes, said Sistine.
Sissy, you look like a hobo. Get in the car.
She tapped her high heel foot on the ground. Sistine didn't move. She stood behind Rob.
Well, said her mother when Sistine didn't move, you must be Rob. What's your last name, Rob?
Horton, Rob said.
Horton, said Mrs. Bailey. Horton, are you related to Selden Horton, the congressman?
No, ma'am, I don't think so.
Mrs. Bailey's eyes flicked away from him and back to Sistine.
Baby, said Mrs. Bailey, please get in the car.
When Sistine still didn't move, Mrs. Bailey sighed and looked back at Rob again.
She won't listen to a word I say, Mrs. Bailey told her. Her father's still the only one she'll listen to.
And then under her breath she muttered, her father the liar.
Sistine growled somewhere deep in her throat and stalked to the car and got in and slammed the door.
You're the liar, she shouted from the back seat of the car. You're the one who lies.
Jesus, said Mrs. Bailey. She shook her head and turned and walked to the car without saying another thing to Rob.
Rob watched them pull away. He couldn't see Sistine sitting in the back seat. Her shoulders were slumped.
A motel room door slammed and somebody laughed. A dog barked once, short and high, then stopped. And then there was silence.
Caroline, Rob whispered into the darkness.
Caroline, Caroline, Caroline.
The word was as sweet as forbidden candy on his tongue.
Chapter 17.
The next morning, Rob was helping Willie May in the laundry room. They were folding sheets and chewing 8-ball gum. All night he had tossed and turned, scratching his legs and thinking about the tiger and what Sistine said, that it had to be set free. He finally decided to get Willie May's opinion.
You ever been to a zoo? Rob asked her.
One time, said Willie May. She cracked her gum.
Went to that zoo over in Sorley. Place stunk.
Do you think them animals minded it, being locked up?
Wasn't nobody asking them, did they mind? Willie May pulled another sheet out of the dryer and snapped it open.
Rob tried again. Do you think it's bad to keep animals locked up?
Willie May looked at him over the top of her glasses. She stared at him hard.
Rob looked down at his feet.
When I wasn't but little, said Willie May, my daddy brought me a bird in a cage. It was a green parakeet bird. The bird was so small I could hold it right in the palm of my hand.
She draped a sheet over one shoulder and held the little cupped hand to show Rob. It looked to him like a hand big enough to hold the entire world.
Held him in my hand. Could feel his little heart beating. He would look at me, cock his head this way and that,
called him Cricket on account of all the time singing. "What happened to him?" Rob asked. Willie Mae bent and took a pillowcase out of the dryer. "Let him go," she said. "You let him go?" Rob repeated, his heart sinking inside him like a stone. "Couldn't stand to see him locked up, so I let him go." She folded the pillowcase carefully. "And then what happened?" "I got beat up by my daddy. He said I didn't do that bird no favor. Said all I did was give some snake its supper."
"So you never saw him again?" Rob asked.
"Nuh-uh," said Willie Mae. "But sometimes he comes flying through my dreams, flitting about and singing." She shook her head and reached for the sheet on her shoulder. "Here," she said, "go on and grab a hold of the other end. Help me fold this up."
Rob took hold of the other end of the sheet, and as it billowed out between them, a memory rose up before him, his father standing out in the yard, holding his gun up to the sky, taking aim at a bird.
"You think I can hit it?" his father said. "You think I can hit that itty-bitty bird?"
"Robert," his mother said, "what do you want to shoot that bird for?"
"To prove I can," said his father. There was a single crack, and the bird was suspended in midair, pinned for a moment to the sky with his father's bullet. Then it fell.
"Oh, Robert," his mother said. It hurt the back of Rob's throat to think about that now, to think about the gun and his mother and the small thud the bird made when it hit the ground.
"I know something that's in a cage," said Rob, pushing the words past the tightening in his throat. Willie Mae nodded her head, but she wasn't listening. She was looking past Rob, past the white sheet, past the laundry room, past the Kentucky Star.
"Who don't?" she said finally. "Who don't know something in a cage?"
After that, they folded the sheets in silence. Rob thought about the bird and how when he finally found his small, still warm body, he had to start to cry. His father told him not to.
"It ain't nothing to cry over," he said. "It's just a bird."
Chapter 18. Rob was sweeping the cement walkway in front of the Kentucky Star rooms when Beauchamp pulled up in his red Jeep and honked the horn.
"Hey there," he hollered. Beauchamp was a large man with orange hair and an orange beard and a permanent toothpick in the side of his mouth. The toothpick waggled as he talked, as if he were trying to make a point of its own.
"We got you on the payroll now, too?" Beauchamp shouted.
"No, sir," said Rob.
"All right," hooted Beauchamp. He hopped out of the Jeep.
"Got you working for free. That's what I like to hear."
"Yes, sir."
"Ain't you supposed to be in school? You done graduated already?"
The gold chains buried deep in Beauchamp's orange chest hair winked at Rob.
"I'm sick," said Rob.
"Sick and tired of school, right?" He slapped Rob on the back.
"Don't got a mama putting down the rules for you, do you? Get to make your own rules."
"Not me," said Beauchamp. He jerked his head in the direction of the motel office where his mother, Ida Bell, worked the front desk. He winked at Rob and then looked to the left, then right.
"Look here," he said in a quieter voice. "I got me a number of deals going on right now, a few more than I can properly handle. I wonder if a smart boy like you wouldn't be looking for a way to pick up some extra spending money."
He didn't wait for Rob to answer.
"Let me tell you what I got cooking. You like animals?"
Rob nodded.
"Course you do," said Beauchamp, nodding with him. "What boy don't? You like wild animals?"
Rob's heart skipped. He suddenly knew where Beauchamp was headed.
"I got me a wild animal," said Beauchamp. "I got me a wild animal like you would not believe, right here on my own property. And I got some plans for him, big plans. But in the meantime, you need some taken care of, like some daily maintenance. You follow me, son?"
"Yes, sir," said Rob.
"All right," said Beauchamp. He slapped Rob on the shoulder again. "Why don't you climb onto this Jeep and let me take you for a ride, show you what I'm talking about."
"I'm supposed to be sweeping," said Rob. He held up the broom.
"Says who?" Beauchamp said, angry. "Your daddy? He ain't the boss. I'm the boss. And if I say let's go, you say all right."
"All right," said Rob. He looked over his shoulder, wishing fervently that Willie Mae or his father would appear to save him from Beauchamp, knowing at the same time he could not be saved, that he was on his own.
"Good," said Beauchamp. "Climb on up."
Rob climbed into the passenger seat. There was a big brown grocery bag at his feet.
"Go on and put that in the back," said Beauchamp as he swung into the driver's seat.
The bag was heavy and it stunk. Rob carefully put it on the floor in the back and then noticed his hands. There was blood on his fingers.
"That's just from the meat," said Beauchamp. "It won't hurt you none."
He cranked the engine. It roared to life and they went tearing around behind the Kentucky Star and into the woods. Beauchamp drove like he was crazy. He gunned for trees and then swerved away from them at the last minute, whooping and hollering the whole time.
"You ain't going to believe what I got to show you," Beauchamp hollered at him.
"No, sir," said Rob weakly.
"What?" Beauchamp shouted. "No, sir," Rob shouted back. "I ain't going to believe it." But he did believe it. He believed it with all his heart.